Please help me welcome Molly from Philly, and her home group is the Philly Speakers Group.
Hi, I'm Molly. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really happy to be here. It's so awesome to get to do anything, to be of service in AA. I absolutely love it, and it's cool to see Paul. Paul just came to our group a couple weeks ago, and Jonathan, and we're outside, and it's beautiful, and this is awesome. So I have a sobriety date. It's August 28th of 2014. I've got about 9.5 months now, which I think is really good news because I thought it was going to take me a really long time to start having any sort of fun in sobriety. You'll hear, when I get into my story that I started having a lot of fun with this thing really, really quickly, right away. I will say, my ego fought me every step of the way, but everything I do today is in an effort to shrink me, to let God in. And so that's what I'm going to try to do right now. So I've got a sponsor. She absolutely knows that she is my sponsor. I never leave her alone. And I sponsor women in the program. And that's really that's the coolest part. That's the most fun that I've ever had in my life. That's the good dope right there. It is. So I'll get out of the way. Now I've qualified myself a little bit and do what I'm supposed to do here, to tell you what it's like, what it was like, what's happened, and what it's like now. So I was born in a hospital in Mount Holly, New Jersey, to two really just wonderful, hardworking people, non-alcoholic. I can't remember a time ever seeing either one of my parents drunk. There was definitely no shortage of love and support in my home life, and it took me until I got here to see that. So born in Mount Holly, we moved to Ewing, New Jersey when I was shortly after I was born, and I lived there till I was about five. This definitely does not make me an alcoholic, but what I think maybe might have happened was that it exacerbated this feeling of disconnection and feeling of difference, and got me to you guys a little bit quicker. When I was 5 years old, it was me, my mom, and my dad, and my older and younger brother in the house in Ewing. My younger brother, he was 3 years old. I was five. He passed away in an accident in our backyard. And that was really hard on my parents. And I spent a lot of time blaming the way that they reacted to that just horrible, horrible tragedy for the way that I was. But I do think that, maybe that made me feel a little bit more apart, that I think I inevitably would have gotten to you guys, but thank God I got to you as soon as I did. So we moved to Newtown shortly after that happened, Newtown, Pennsylvania, probably about 40 minutes from here. I'm not totally sure, but I was talking to somebody in my family not too long ago, and my grandmother, she's a very understanding, she knows what I'm doing in AA, and she wants to know more about it. She's really interested in what we're doing, this altruistic movement for, people that have problems with alcohol and with living. So I told her a little bit about what it was like to be me growing up. She asked me when did you start feeling this way? And I think I started feeling that big hurt, that I think most of us have experienced when I was about 8 years old. That's around the time I remember I couldn't keep a friend for more than a couple weeks. I just remember feeling everybody was over here, doing their thing, getting through the school day and having friends and playing on the playground. And then I was watching from the outside over here, just desperately trying to find a way to get in. And one of the earliest things I tried to do to feel that was, I kind of had this idea that if you were looking at me, maybe I would feel a part of whatever, whatever you're doing, whatever's going on with you, I'd feel a part of the group and a part of what's going on here and in the present moment, right? So I just like, for me, it just looked like a lot of like, you know, doing crazy inappropriate stuff to get attention and to make you look at me. And so I got into some like silly little trouble when I was a kid, and I just felt like so alone in the world, man. Like, so around the time I was like in middle school, that's when we started with the rotation of like therapy and medications and diagnoses and, you know, everything in the book that kind of looks like untreated alcoholism they pinned me with. I gave up on all that. The thing about me and therapists is I can never really be honest with those people. There's something so different about sitting with a therapist and telling them about my problems and, you know, sitting across from somebody who I know, I believe, has known exactly how I've felt and has done the things I've done and I can, you know, trust them that they know what I'm going through. So none of that stuff really ever worked for me. And I just, you know, I always tell this story when I speak. I was like, between the ages of like 11 and 13, I got this idea that there was a murderer in the world that knew, I figured he was probably from like Brooklyn, New York, that knew where I lived and had, you know, wanted to come to my house and murder me, and probably my family too. They'd be witnesses. I'd probably scream and stuff. So I would stay awake at night for like 2 straight years, all night, shaking and sweating and trying to figure out, planning my escape route and what I would do to save myself and at least my sisters, for the inevitable moment when the murderer, you know, came to get me. God, I was just like a mess of a human being from as early on as I can remember. And so that's kind of what I was bringing to the table. When I was 14, my older brother was 18, and he had just discovered drinking. He was like in college, my parents were away on vacation, so I was staying at my grandma's house, and he was staying at our parents' house, and he decided to have, like, a party with his, like, old friends from high school, because they'd all, like, started drinking, they wanted to do it together, whatever, so I go to, I like, weaseled my way into that situation somehow. I was like, you know, if I'm not invited, I will tell mom and dad that you had a party in their house, so you might want to invite me, So I got into that, and so there were stipulations on this night, I knew I was going to be drinking. I was like, I thought that was a good idea. I definitely didn't do it because I was an alcoholic, but, you know, I was kind of attracted to, like, the stuff that, like, the bad kids were doing, I remember before I ever picked up a drink or anything else, I remember, like, going to PetSmart and buying, like, catnip with my friend, thinking, like, maybe that would get us high. And, like, it doesn't work, I'll tell you right now. You don't have to try it. It tastes kind of nice, but... So I get to this party, and so I'm like, I'm nervous. I want these like kids to think I'm cool. It's like my chance. I definitely don't fit in with people my age, right? But like maybe like I could have like older friends, and like I want my brother to think I'm cool. My whole life, I still do want him to think I'm cool. And so I'm nervous, and I get dressed, and I'm wearing these like tight jeans and like a black tank top, and I don't really like the way like everything is like stuffed in there. So I take like this huge like men's XXL sweatshirt and like put it all like over top of everything, and so I'm in this like giant like trench coat of a sweatshirt in the corner, you know, watching everybody sort of like catch up, and there's like a kid from my high school too who's there, a couple kids from my high school, and like I'm watching them talk and you know, kind of just the way that I am in those situations, you know what I mean? By the time I've thought of anything to say on the topic that you're discussing, you stop talking about that thing like 5 minutes ago, so I'm just like so uncomfortable, So my brother puts their stipulations on this night, right? So I have to be home to my grandma's house by 9 o'clock, and I'm allowed to have one drink an hour. And I'm like already doing the math in my head. I'm like, so that's like 3 all night. Okay. And so he pours me like a Captain Morgan mojito mix thing, and I drink that, and it doesn't taste too bad. It's like kind of sweet, and nothing really happened, but you know, it wasn't a terrible experience for me. And so he went upstairs, and this kid, he was like a year older than me. I knew him from school. He was like, "So you've never been drunk before?" And I'm like, "No." And so he hands me like a bottle of Goldschlager, that like the cinnamon schnapps stuff, and. So he's like, you know, have some of this. And so I watch him take a swig of it, and he hands it to me. And so I take a swig, and then I take another swig. And it became very clear to me, like, right within a couple minutes of that this one drink an hour rule was not going to fly. And I was probably going to have to ask for a time extension on my curfew. and I'll tell you, the sweatshirt came off. And I was like, you know, I was good. Like, I was like, you know, I was there. And like, that's really like, that's what drinking does for me. It's like, I get to just like be here right now with you guys. We're all friends. I can sit and talk to you about anything for hours, as long as we have enough of this stuff to get me through the conversation. You know, I was like comfortable in a way that I never felt, and it felt like the most exciting night of my life, even though we were just hanging around my house. The problem though with that is, because that's what alcohol does for me. But the one drink an hour rule and the home by nine thing, like that didn't work. Because what happens with me is I get to a point where I'm like, okay, this is good, right? And then I'm like, I bet it could get better. And so I keep going, and you know, I you know, it looks like I'm always just trying to get to like this point, this like awesome, like the ultimate buzz, and it always looks like it's on the next drink, no matter how many I've had. And you know, so I end up just getting so drunk, and he has to call. We told my grandma we were playing Scrabble. He has to like call her and be like, "We want a rematch. She's gonna stay a little while longer." And because he can't send me home in that condition, I'm like falling all over the place and having the time of my life. And then the older kids, they go upstairs, and like I go up to follow them, figure out what they're doing, and they pull out some green stuff, and I'd heard about that stuff. I like only the really bad kids do that stuff, but I was pretty much down for anything. I was intrigued. So, I did some of that stuff that night, and that kind of thing would pop up for me, you know, later on. I have a positive reaction to a lot of things other than alcohol. But so I go home that night, and I stumble into my grandparents' house, get past them somehow. I go upstairs, I puke a couple times, and I wake up the next morning, and I'm like ready to do that again. I like, you know, I'm like telling all my friends, like, you will not believe like what I discovered on Friday night. And you know, and there's that like mental obsession where I'm just like, I'm thinking about it all the time. So my high school drinking was not like anything too crazy. I guarantee I took it to the wall every single time I got my hands on it. But I was like 14. I wasn't hanging out with the cool kids who were drinking. I was like in the theater group, and they all thought I was like really weird. By senior year, I'd gotten most of them to get drunk with me, and I thought that was like a huge feat. But so then I somehow get into college, and I definitely did not qualify for this university, but I went to Stony Brook University, and things kind of took off there. Like, it looked to me like I wasn't like, you know, I'm going to get a good education and get a good job, and I don't have like that kind of foresight. I'm like, how can I feel good right now? And that's what my college years were like. I was able to drink exactly the way I wanted, and I was a broke college kid, so I had to do like a lot of shady things to do that. And I got introduced to some types of, you know, behaviors and substances that I'd never been introduced to before. And I started to get to run with a crowd that, you know, that liked to do the kind of things that I did and drink the way that I like to drink. And you know, and then I had a lot of, you know, I would go through like groups of friends in college. Like, people would meet me at a party and think I was like, you know, fun and, you know, easygoing and whatever. And then they would drink with me like three more times and like never want to see me again. And, and that's pretty much how that went. And so, but by the end, I didn't graduate. I stayed for 2 years, and you know, my parents could see that like there was, you know, I couldn't get myself to class, and you know, I I could not maintain any sort of like decent grade point average without like calling my teachers and like manipulating them. It's been like a really hard semester, and I'm under so much pressure. And so anyway, so I have to leave, and because my dad just doesn't want to pay for me to party anymore. And so I think, you know, what I'm telling everybody is like, all right, I'm going to move to New York, and things are going to, you know, I can't be like held down in like this university like setting. I need like a bigger pool so I can like, you know, I can grow and whatever. And really, like, I just knew that I couldn't like maintain any level of normalcy with my drinking in college. And so I thought if I left, like, I would be fine. And so I leave and I move to LBI for the summer. And it's like a nice, I don't know if you guys have been to LBI. It's not like Wildwood. It's like, we just got back from there. I'm like very red, but it's not like Wildwood. It's like a nice little family beach town. And, but I make it college. I make it like a frat row right away. And, you know, it gets worse. Like every time I tried to go somewhere else and thought, with a different group of people under different circumstances, I thought that it was going to get better, and it just didn't. And by then I was like, you know, drinking all throughout the day, blacking out at work, like going home, drinking more, waking up still drunk, continuing to drink, and just like in that cycle. And it's just bad. And so I finally moved to New York at the end of the summer. And what happened to me there was really interesting, because by that point, people were coming at me from all sides saying, you know, if you just would stop drinking, like, you're going to be fine. Like, you just got to, like, stop doing this. Like, just get it under control. And so, you know, I think, like, if I stop drinking, things will get better. And I moved to New York. I'm completely broke. I don't know anybody. I'm underage. And so I can't get the things that I'm used to getting. And I pretty much stayed. Like, I drank kind of, I guess, like normal people do. Like, I drank like a handful of times while I was there for like 3.5 months. And what happened to me was like, so when I'm in a state of sobriety, like, things don't get better for me. You know what I mean? Like, I ended up getting this apartment. And within like a week of being there, being sober, I couldn't leave the apartment. I was full of just like heart pounding, just walking out the door anxiety. And I couldn't get on the subway to get to my crappy part-time job, most days of the week, because I'm so self-centered. I'll like walk into a subway. Like, I'm in like a major metropolitan area, like New York City, and I think everybody is looking at me and being like, why does her hair look like that? And she doesn't belong here. Like, so it was a mess. And I started, so I don't feel right. So what I do when I don't feel right is I start looking around for like who I can blame, and I start blaming the people that I'm living with who've done nothing but like support me. They get fed up with that real quick. And I was all but kicked out by the time I left. And my dad came and rescued me from New York and brought me home to Newtown. And and I stayed in that state for a little while longer at my parents' house. And, you know, I have this like thing that the book talks about, this spiritual malady, you know, that is treated by alcohol. But when I'm not giving it alcohol, it will find other things to treat it. You know what I mean? It demands to be treated. And so I start doing like other crazy behaviors and, you know, like this like self, the like, pseudo suicidal and like this eating disorder stuff. And I'm just like a disaster of a person. And I don't know what happened to me, because I remember like at one point, like in college and stuff, I was like kind of popular, and like I was at least able to like be around people and feel kind of normal sometimes. And, you know, I just progressed to this point where I just couldn't function. And so I had signed up for a ski trip like several months before that with some old college friends. And so I go on that trip, even though I really don't feel like being around other people. And what happens is I spend 4 days in Canada not skiing. But I find the people who have, like, you know, who brought a nice stock of alcohol, probably people who are like me. And I follow them around the whole trip, and I black out for 4 days. And I come back having just, like, burned all the friendships that I had when I went there, and you know, sick and like hallucinating on the train and like on the way home, and just physically gross. I didn't shower like the whole time I was there. But the way that I felt when I got, you know, when I got done with that trip, I was like, I'm back. Like, I forgot, like, this is what I'm on this earth to do. I'm supposed to be doing that as much as possible because I haven't felt that good in months. And so within 2 weeks of that, I got kicked out of my parents' house and I went on this like final run. I got to, within a couple days of that trip, I got 2 bartending jobs. So I was bartending full time. I had a car within a week from that trip, and I had no one to be accountable to. And I just went. And by the end of that, you know, I wasn't drinking like to have fun anymore. Like that was over. I was drinking because I couldn't eat or sit still. I couldn't stop shaking. I couldn't sleep, unless I had like a bottle next to me and I was like nice and loaded and you know, let alone just feeling like normal in my head, I was like physically sick. And so I end up crashing my car into a couple other cars and parked cars. Nobody was hurt, thank God. It was just a nice little warning sign for me that that something needed to change. I remember getting into the back of that cop car when I got arrested for that, and you know, he asked me like, "What were you thinking?" And I'm an alcoholic. There was no like thinking about it. There was just like, I'm drinking tonight. If I got to drive to get to the next place, like I'm going to drive. But he's like, "What were you thinking?" And I was like, you know, I don't know. So, you know, something like this had to happen. I've been running so, so hard for so long. Eventually I was going to run into something. And he suggested that I maybe get some help. And then the next day, I went to my parents' house and they'd found out like on the streets. I live in a really small town. They found out on the streets of Newtown that I had gotten a DUI the night before and my car was totaled and stuff. And they were like, "Look, we've been noticing like this out of control behavior for a few years. We think it's time for you to do something. Do you think you have a problem with drinking and drugs?" And I'm like, "No, I don't have a problem with alcohol. Like, I intuitively knew there's something like very wrong deep inside of me. But I'll do whatever you guys want to make you happy right now." What I said was, "I think you guys should send me to therapy. Like, I'm just messed up. Like, I drink a little bit too much, but you'd probably drink the way that I drink if you felt like me too." And, they say, like, "Why don't you, I was like, they're like, "Go to rehab." And still to this day, rehab sounds like the most horrible experience, like, that I can possibly think of. Just, like, being sober with a bunch of other, like, miserable sober people talking about myself. And so I was like, no rehab. That's, like, that's for people who are really bad. I'll go to AA. And the next day I walked into an AA meeting. And, you know, I don't know. Some, you know, people came up to the, you know, it's what you AA people do, you know what I mean? Somebody says they're new, it's their first meeting, you come up after and you talk to them and you give them a big book, and yeah, I just was at a point where I was, like, not ready to buy into anything. I had just, like, this head was fighting so hard, man. And it took me a couple weeks of, you know, going to meetings drunk and leaving to go to the bar and stuff, until, you know, I was done fighting. And what happened was this girl that I had met at a meeting when I was intoxicated a couple nights before, she texted me. It was like a week and a half before, and she did what the good AA people do, you know what I mean? She met a new person who looked like they were dying. And so she invited me out and invited me out and invited me out until finally I, like, gave in and was like, okay, I'll come hang out with you. And so I don't know, I reached that point, that little moment, that like precious moment of grace where I was ready to just listen to whatever anybody told me because I knew that I had no idea what I was doing and that everything I tried had failed and I was just out of ideas for a minute, you know what I mean? And if that girl had waited any longer to text me, I might have gotten a new one and I wouldn't be here right now. But she asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with her an hour away in Easton. And I was like, "That sounds horrible. Like, I'm going to have to, like, sit in the car with this girl for an hour. I'm not going to be able to be drunk. And she's probably going to want to talk to me about, like, my life and stuff. And I'm going to have to listen to her talk about her life, which is even worse." And, like, I just, like, I didn't think it was going to be fun. But But I said, yeah. And, like, you know, saying okay to things that I think are not going to be fun have, like, absolutely saved my life in sobriety time and time again. So I get in the car, and she takes me to this meeting in Easton where a friend of mine, who actually is my roommate now, and Alex right here, they were there, and Greg, our friend Greg, was speaking, and, you know, he's 5 years sober, and he got sober when he was 17, and I'm here, I was 21, and I thought I was absolutely too young to be in sobriety. I'm like, I bet I can ride this out for a few more years until I die at least, like, and I heard him talk, man, and, like, I had that, like, that really important moment where I know that he had the same thing that I have. He talked about how he feels when he's drinking and how he feels when he's sober and the kind of stuff that he got into. And he was telling my story. And I came to believe that, you know, he felt the way that I felt and did the stuff I did. And he did not suffer from this thing anymore. It looked like he was having fun with it, actually. You know, you see those people. There are people in this group like that that just have that, like, light on in their eyes. You know what I mean? And if those people can convince you that that they were where you're at, you know, those people, you know, have the tools to save your life. And so after the meeting, we went to Applebee's, and I looked around. These people were, like, happy. They were, like, laughing and making jokes and talking about their lives, and really just, like, anybody who was, like, sober and having a conversation with each other that seemed to be, like, relatively easy was just, like, baffling to me. On the car ride home, this girl started talking to me about the steps, and she started talking to me about powerlessness and unmanageability, And I know that another drink always looks like a good idea. Like, I don't really need to, like, do much work to figure that out. I did all the work in the previous years of my life that it's not a good idea for me to start. And I also knew that, like, I really don't know when I'm going to start again once I've stopped. And then I don't really, like, have any choice in the matter of you know, when I'm going to feel like it's necessary to pick up again. And then she asked me if I believed in God, and I was like, no, okay, whoa, like, we're moving really fast here. This God thing, I don't know about that. Like, I'm an atheist. It's very important to me that I'm an atheist. You know, I thought I was, like, an educated atheist. Like, I've taken philosophy classes, and I know about Nietzsche, God is dead, like, calm down. And, you know, she said, like, you know, she asked me, just like our book says, you know, if I was willing to believe, what she said was, is it possible that you're not, like, the center of the universe, and that maybe there's, like, some sort of consciousness that's, like, bigger than you? And I was like, maybe. And she was like, awesome, let's move on. And and so then she started talking to me about the third step, and she explained the third step with me. We did the prayer. I didn't do a third step until, I didn't have, like, an experience with the third step until about a week later. I had to drink two more times in between. And that was me going to meetings and, like, having a sponsor that I was talking to every day and you know, having four step instructions in front of me. None of that is, like, enough. When it's on me, it's on me. And so my third step experience, like, after that last, like, I ate, like, a bunch of pills or whatever on August 27th. And after that, like, I had taken the third step. And what she explained to me was that was, like, it was kind of like this contract. It was like, you know, I'm out of ideas, right? Like, I have no idea what I'm doing with my life. I know that, like, I can't drink anymore, but I know that I can't be sober either. I've had experiences with both, and neither of them have been any good. You know, anything you want to throw at me, like, I'll do whatever you say, and I'll go through with the rest of these steps. And if something happens to me, it's not like I've got anything better going on, so I might as well try it. But if something happens to happen to me, I'm going to go out and I'm going to bear witness. I'm going to share it with as many people as I can find. And so I did. You know, she picked me up in her car the next day and said we were going to Maryland. And so I was like, okay. And we got in, and I got in the car, and she pulled out a legal pad, and she was like, you're going to write a four-step right now. And so I wrote my four-step on the way there, and we went through. I did a fifth step on the way back. You know, in that fifth step, it's like I saw myself for the first time. You know what I mean? She asked me to look at situations in my life in a way that I never would have even considered. Like, I look at life through this, like, me lens, you know what I mean? And all I can see is, like, this world as it affects me. And it doesn't look good when I'm thinking like that. And, you know, one example is, like, those people that I lived with in New York. The one guy that I, this friend from college, we were best friends in college, and we decided to move to New York together, and, you know, we were best friends, and I was sure that he had just ruined my life. Like, I was going to be a big deal in New York, and I was going to make my way there, and he just, like, you know, he got this, like, big important job, and he was supposed to be, I was there, like, I studied acting in college, I was there to be an actress or whatever, and he got this job at a casting agency, and he didn't use any of his pull to, like, help me out. You know, he got me, like, he was my agent, we signed a contract, he got me, like, two auditions the whole time I was there, and he would come home late and leave early in the morning, and we barely talked, and he didn't buy cat litter, and he was just, like, the worst friend. And so, and he ruined my life, and he just kicked me out, like, on my ass to, like, fend for myself in this horrible world. And so she, like, you know, I don't even remember what exactly it was she said when I told her this sob story, but she was like, something like, is it possible that, like, somewhere down the line, like, you weren't the best friend you could have been to this guy? And things started to click with me, like, when she said that, and I, like, really had to think, like, was there a time, like, maybe I wasn't, like, a great friend, and over a little bit of time, and I started, like, thinking about it differently, you know what I mean? I thought about it, and so from his perspective, it was probably, like, something like, so he has this friend in college, and I'm, like, fun, and I've always got, like, a ton of people with me, and you know, I take him to a lot of parties, and we're in the same theater group together, and I'm getting, like, these, like, roles in the plays, and he's getting all these directing jobs and stuff, and we're kind of, like, just doing the same thing. We've got a common primary purpose, and then we get to New York after I've been just drinking 24/7 all summer, and I'm, like, a completely different person. Like, I won't leave the apartment. I don't want to do anything fun unless, you know, unless we're going to get drunk. And, like, I don't reach out to him. And he gets me these two auditions, and I show up half an hour late for one of them, and I don't show up to the other one. And here I am, like, expecting him to, like, put his butt on the line at his, like, cool new job that he's hoping to work his way up in, and, you know, and risk, like, his position by bringing his, like, you know, non-functional, like, psycho roommate to like, meet his, like, employers. And eventually I just, like, turn on him and I start yelling at him all the time. And by the time, like, that night that he kicked me out, by the time I came barging into his room, screaming his name, ready to confront him about all the wrongs that he's done to me, by that time he'd probably just had, like, enough of me. You know, like, everybody else, like, he probably had just, like, gotten to, like, this point where he just, like, couldn't stand to be around me anymore. I sucked the life out of people. And I just had this, like, crazy perception change about this thing that I thought was just such a big deal in my life. And you know, we went through every person that I thought had wronged me, and every situation, every circumstance where I thought, like, this world had treated me wrong. And she turned it around on me. and that's when this, like, shift in perception started to happen. And I started to, like, really, not even necessarily consciously, but, like, when I would get upset, I would be like, can I look at this from another angle? Like, what might the other side to this be? And I went home that night for my, like, sixth step, you know, that I was taught. The action in the sixth step is I take an hour of quiet meditation, and I reflect on what I've done in the past, you know, five steps, and think about if I've left anything out. And I sat, and it was, like, the quietest hour of my life. Like, it was like, I've got this head that's, like, constantly just going, just gnawing at me. and it's so loud sometimes, it's like deafening. And I sat there for that hour, and I sat still, and I was just there, and I felt like for the first time in a really long time, I was doing something positive. From that moment on, I was like sold, you know, I was all in. And, you know, immediately after that, so I did the 7-step prayer, with her the next day. We held hands. I thought it was really weird. She had me run out and start making amends right after that. And, you know, I continue to make amends. I made one like a couple days ago last week. But I've had some really cool experiences with the 9-step. So I have two little sisters, and the older of the two. So like I mentioned before, like my little brother passed away when I was 5, and both my sisters were born after that. And so they grew up, like, there's like not an alcoholic bone in these girls' body. They're like smart and like funny, and you know, I always felt as though mom and dad favored them. And my one sister, she's like an athlete and she's a great student and she's like a social butterfly and she's everything that I never was able to be. And it all came so easy to her, and I just hated her. And so I would like, she's a lot younger than me, but I would like beat her up and stuff and call her names. And you know, the last time she saw me before I got sober, I called her from the bar, and I was like, I want to see you, but not if mom and dad are there. And so she said they weren't home, and I went over there, and I'd done like some other things that I tend to like to do, make me a little bit more energetic and talkative. And I go over there and I tell this like, you know, really innocent 15-year-old girl, I'm like, look, you know, mom, this is like every wrong thing mom and dad have ever done in their life. You don't know the kind of people that your parents are. Your whole life is a lie. Dad's delusional, and mom just follows him around everywhere. And, and like, don't trust anything they say. And, you know, if they ever say anything that sounds kind of funny to you, you call me and I'll tell you what's really going on. And like all this, like just nuts stuff. And she's just like, okay. And like, then I leave, and she doesn't see me again until I'm sober. And so I got to go back to her, and I made this amends pretty early. Verbally, I made this amends pretty early in sobriety. I'd been sober like a couple weeks, I think, 2 weeks maybe. And I sat down with her, and you know, I asked her for, at her convenience, like a minute of her time, and we started talking about, you know, I talked about the things that I've done and how wrong I was for having done that, and how, you know, she's the last person in the world who deserves to be treated like that, especially by her older sister. You know, I'm supposed to set an example for her and be there for her, and I just failed to do that my whole life. And I asked her if I left anything out. She brought up the time that she was 9 and I asked her to pee in a cup for me, which I was hoping she wouldn't do. So I asked her if I can do anything to make it right. So this girl, she's a junior Olympic swimmer. She's like, you know, the top of her high school swim team. She has like a private swim team, and she's been doing this since she was like 6 years old. She's absolutely a nut about it. She swims 7 days a week. I think it's insane. But, and I've never been to a single one of her swim meets. So she says, like, she hugs me, she cries. She says, I just want you to get better. And then she says, and come to one of my swim meets. Like, and I was like, okay, I can do that. When I followed through with that, I got to do that like a few months later. My, you know, there's nothing on the AA schedule that night. So she had this like big swim meet, and she did so well, dude. She got 2 second place medals, and she was like only a sophomore. She's swimming against kids that are older than her, been doing it longer than her. She does just like amazing. And I see her like with her friends, and like she's so happy, and like, and I like cried the whole time. Like, and this feeling, like when I followed through with that amends, like something came over me where like I could not believe that I ever thought anything negative in my life about this like beautiful, intelligent, funny, talented, like athletic, just like sweet girl. I just like couldn't believe it. Like that resentment that like I hung on to, like that like held me for a long time, just melted away. And like I just was like bawling the whole time. I was so proud of her. And we have like an awesome relationship now. You know, I walk into the house and she runs up and hugs me and she's like, "Molly, I love you." And I'm like, "Wow, so much love." And I call her, you know, we talk a couple times every week and we keep up in each other's lives and like that's so cool. You know what I mean? I can't believe I get to like mend a relationship like that. And there've been so many others. I've made a lot of amends. I've had a lot of cool relationships or cool experiences with that. So I did that and, she talked to me a little bit, my sponsor, she talked to me a little bit about, you know, 10 and 11, you know, 10, the way I practice that, I kind of, as I'm going about my day, when I see this stuff pop up and, you know, I ask God to remove it. If I can't use the tools that you guys have taught me to get around it and see like where I'm wrong, I take it to my sponsor, another alcoholic who I've given spiritual license to, you know, where they can tell me the truth and I can take it. In the 11th step, you know, I do what the book tells me to do. You know, I pray constantly, third step and seventh step prayer all day. The most important prayer that I've ever done is like, "God, please show me how to be of service." And I do my, you know, morning. I fall short on this like more often than I would like to admit, but, you know, I try to do the morning meditation, ask God to direct my thinking but I always start my day with like, "Show me how to be of service." I know like, you know, once I got like towards that ninth step and like I'll get into 12th step next, like God has become God that like I completely like had just, you know, renounced from the time I was like 14, has become an absolutely undeniable fact in my life. Like I see it all over the place today. And you know, it's just, it's so cool. And so I do, I pray and I try to, you know, I try to keep my relationship close with my creator, you know, with my feet, you know what I mean? I try to keep moving and doing his work. And when I do that, like things usually work out really nicely for me. So I'm 23 days sober, right? And I'm doing this stuff and I'm out making amends and I'm on fire. I'm like running around telling everybody how great AA is. And my sponsor takes me into Philadelphia and she's like, "This is Autumn. She's been sober like 2 days and she needs a sponsor. She wants to go through the steps. You're going to take her through the steps." And I was like, "That's such a bad idea." But I did it because she told me to. And, you know, within a few days, I was sitting across from that girl listening to her fifth step and just using, you know, I use the steps, you know, as tools to make me more useful to other people. I just, you know, I have experience with, you know, doing my fifth step. I can, you know, listen to your fifth step. And I did exactly what my sponsor did with me. You know, I tried to point out to her where she'd been selfish and where she'd been wrong and like, you know, another way to look at those situations. And you know, and we talked about her conduct and her fear and like in that it took like forever, dude. Those things take like so long for some people. Mine was particularly long. That's why I know that. So I'm sitting with this girl and it's like 4 or 5 hours later and like she leaves and like I realized that for the past like 4 or 5 hours, I was like right there the whole time. You know what I mean? Like I, like all this like craziness and like my head spinning and like, you know, what am I doing next? And like, I can't believe I said that to that guy yesterday and you know, how am I going to make enough money to do the stuff I want to do? And like, oh my God, I'm not good enough. How am I ever going to be good enough? Like everybody hates me. All that like chatter, that like calamity had just like slowed down and like stopped. Are we just going to, okay, cool. You know, that's what my life's about today. You know what I mean? Like, when I sit across from another alcoholic, share my experience, strength, and hope for the purpose of recovery, you know, something just like, it just all, it slows down. And I'm able to be like present, like in the moment. And like, I thought I got close to that feeling. You know what I mean? When I was like real lit up by alcohol and like maybe I had like a couple other things in me, like the scene was good and like the music was good you know, we were dancing and having a good time. I thought I was like almost there then, but I needed like one more drink. this is the ease and comfort. Like this is the relief that I was always looking for, is just being able to do that. And it's like, it's so cool. I can't believe like what I've stumbled upon. You know, that girl, she's like running around somewhere in Philly, but there have been like a few in between. And every time I'm given an opportunity to be of service and pass on what was done for me, like, you know, I jump on it. I'm like, I'm full-time AA. So now, you know, we started a group in West Philly and University City around the time I had like 60 days. Being a part of a home group that really like makes an effort to like stick together, and we like run around and do stuff together like almost every night of the week. I got two home group members here with me right now. You know, we all go out to eat after the meeting, and we started out with like an hour speaker meeting on Wednesdays, and now we've got a big book study on Thursdays and another one we start tomorrow on Tuesdays in Frankfurt. And that's just been like so cool to be a part of. It gives me so many opportunities to be more active, be surrounded by people who will, you know, show me, direct me how to be more active. I just moved out of my grandma's house finally. You know, God put me in a position. Things just worked out like unbelievably. I'd been staying on my grandma's couch to the point where it felt like it didn't feel right inside to be like taking from this woman who's been done nothing but give to me her whole life, and I've done nothing but take. And right around the time that started to happen, I came into like some money. God just like dropped into my lap, I went to my sponsor and I was like, do you think it's a good idea for me to move to Philly? And usually when I think something's a good idea, she tells me it's stupid. But this time she was like, I think you'll have way more opportunities to be of service if you move to Philly. She said, start looking for a sober roommate. The next day, my home group member, you know, she texted me and said, like, Greg's looking for a sober roommate in Philly. And within 2 weeks of that, we found this awesome apartment, like, a couple of blocks from our home group. I got a job a few blocks from there working with my sponsor at a restaurant. Now, I mean, it's like living in an AA clubhouse. We've got, like, Greg's got a guy he's helping on an inflatable mattress on the kitchen floor, and a girl I'm helping staying on the futon, and you know, we just like stay up till all hours of the night talking about AA and how much we love it and our experiences, and like, and we run around in meetings together, and you know, it's so cool, man. It's so cool. It's you know, I never thought I could have like a life like this. I have a host of friends, and I have a purpose today that Tom Flynn says it makes me feel downright upright, and that's it. I think I'm out of time. I'm really happy to be here, and thank you so much for having me out. This is awesome.